wait until the until your adversaries have a chance to claim their seats. Mr. Beisner.
May it please the court, my name is John Beisner. I'm counsel for defendant appellant Ford Motor Company. In recent years, federal courts, including this one, have raised serious concerns about the certification of nationwide product liability or product warranty class actions. In those cases, which typically involve a single type of product, such proposed classes are routinely rejected. And as this court noted in the Szabo case, such cases pose serious problems about choice of law, manageability, and a host of other issues. Apparently not getting the message that such single product cases are of dubious certifiability, the named plaintiffs in this case proposed, and the district court certified, something even more ambitious. This purported class action is not about just one product. It's about a variety of 60 million Firestone tires that plaintiffs contend are subject to tread separation incidents, and a variety of 3 million Explorer Sport utility vehicles that plaintiffs contend have an unreasonable propensity to be involved in rollover accidents. There's no way around it. What the district court has certified here is a true crazy quilt class. At the center is a group of persons who bought Explorer vehicles that were equipped with the allegedly defective Firestone tires. Those class members allege the purchase of two types of defective products, the vehicles and the tires. Then off to one side, there's a class of persons who bought Explorer vehicles that were equipped not with the allegedly defective Firestone tires, but with Goodyear tires, about whom no one has made any defect allegation. So those folks are suing only about the vehicles that they bought. Over on the other side, we have a group of folks who allegedly bought defective Firestone tires. They didn't buy a vehicle, just tires. They're only suing about tires. Now, according to the certification ruling, the district court plans to have a single trial covering all of these claims at the same time. It will be the ultimate mishmash class trial, a case in which millions of people who just went out and bought tires will have their claims tried simultaneously with a group of people who just went out and bought vehicles, tried simultaneously with a group of people who happened to go out and buy both tires and vehicles at the same time. And adding to the mix is the fact that some class members no longer own the vehicles or the tires, and some people bought their tires or vehicles used. So the class trial proposed here presents all of the problems involved in the sort of product warranty cases that federal courts have routinely rejected, times at least two or three. Against that backdrop, it's not surprising that on point after point, plaintiffs basically argue that they should get a pass, that they should be exempt from satisfying the normal litigation burdens. For example, they suggest that since this matter arises out of an MDL grouping of class actions, that they should not be required to satisfy the rigorous certification requirements of Rule 23. And they urge that to prevail on their claims, they don't even have the burden to prove that any of the products at issue here are defective. There's a good reason why plaintiffs make these give us a pass arguments, because measured against the normal procedural and substantive law standards, this class certification ruling is not defensible. It can be upheld only if this court is willing to overturn numerous points of longstanding law. The indefensibility of the class certification order below is perhaps most readily apparent in its handling of choice of law issues. Over the past 20 years, plaintiffs' counsel have repeatedly sought out ways to secure certification of nationwide state law-based class actions. Typically, the core strategy has been to try to find some way to homogenize the widely varying state laws, to find a way to satisfy Rule 23B3's predominance of common legal question argument by trying to say the law is the same with respect to all jurisdictions. They tried to argue that certain federal statutes have essentially federalized state product liability laws. That was attempted in Walsh, and the D.C. Circuit roundly rejected that notion back in 1985. They tried to argue that product liability laws don't vary from state to state or can be handled with some sort of Esperanto-type jury instruction that would give an averaging of all of these varying laws. But that approach was voided by this court in the Roan-Palenque decision. Now it's popular to argue that choice of law analyses permit the application of one state's laws to claims asserted by millions of residents of all 50 states. Now that notion's been rejected by the Ninth Circuit in Zinder. It's been rejected by the Fifth Circuit in both the Spence and the Bronco 2 cases, both of which, I should add, the latter two, have considerable similarity to this case. And it ultimately has been rejected, as far as I know, by every federal court to have ultimately rejected by every federal court to have considered
the issue. Of course, the underlying question is one of state law. What have state courts said about this possibility?
The state courts have said that there are many state court precedents that we have cited that have said that you've got to follow normal state law precedents here. I mean,
are there any states that have announced that they will apply one set of law in products liability cases?
There have been several cases, Your Honor, in which that determination has been made in the laws of some states. That has not been true, though, in Indiana. And the duty
so your real position is that the plaintiffs made an imprudent venue choice from their perspective.
I don't believe that's correct, Your Honor, because I think that even in states that have ventured into that category, there are real questions about the constitutionality of a state saying that it will apply its law to all claims in a particular action.
Well, I could understand that, but let's suppose, perhaps this is simply fantasy, that Alabama were to decide that all products liability cases involving Ford would be decided under Michigan law.
If Alabama were to make that decision under a choice of law analysis, the question would be whether that meets constitutional due process considerations as set forth in Schutt.
It's awfully hard to see how Ford could object. I might imagine some plaintiff class members objecting, but of course they'd all be consenting, as in Schutt's. But why a manufacturer would object as an initial matter to saying that the law of the state where the product is designed and manufactured governs, you know, you've talked about what plaintiffs have been saying for the last 20 years. For a very long time, that was the manufacturer's position.
Now
you seem to be saying there might be some constitutional problem with the traditional manufacturer's home state law position.
I think what manufacturers have been saying in that regard, Your Honor, in some contexts, there have been suggestions along the way that Congress should pass laws that should federalize product liability claims so they would be uniform nationwide. But Congress has not done so. And the duty of this court, or any federal court approaching this issue, is to look at what the forum state's choice of law principles dictate and apply them. And that is the obligation here. As Your Honor notes, the district court here determined that the laws of Michigan would apply to all class claims against Ford and the laws of Tennessee would apply to all class claims against Firestone, the rationale being that the laws of the state where design decisions were made about the defective product should apply. The problem is that this lacks any grounding in Indiana choice of law precedents. Indeed, over the last 50 years, Indiana state appellate courts have confronted many non-personal injury product warranty cases in which the primary product design decision occurred in a state other than where the product was purchased and used. And as was reflected in the record, we reviewed all of those reported decisions, and in none of those cases, not one, did the Indiana courts opt for the law of the jurisdiction where the product design decision making occurred. That should not be a surprise if you step back and look at the precedent that this ruling set. It means that if one asserts an economic loss claim regarding a product, regarding a mass-produced product that is sold in whatever jurisdiction, the claim normally will be governed by the law of the jurisdiction where the design decisions about the product were made. So if I were to buy, as an Indiana resident, buy a product in Indiana, and that product were a computer that were designed and manufactured in Korea, under this analysis, Korea law would apply to my warranty claim. We respectfully submit that is not Indiana choice of law. The Consumer Protection Act claims in this case are governed by Indiana's tort choice of law principles. Those are laid out in detail in the recent decision of this court in Land versus Yamaha Mortar. And in that case, the court rejected an assertion similar to what's made here, and that is that the law of the jurisdiction in which decisions were made about product design should apply. As Land makes clear, Indiana uses a modified version of the lex loci choice of law inquiry with respect to tort claims. And under that test, the law of the state where the injury occurs absolutely governs, unless it's a mere fortuity that the injury occurred there. As the Fifth Circuit observed in the Spence case, in an economic loss case like this involving a product, the alleged economic injury would occur where the product was purchased. And that really is no disagreement about that point in this case between the court or the plaintiffs. The place of injury here is not a mere fortuity. It's in most instances where the purchaser resides, it's where the deal was made, it's where the product delivered. And under Indiana choice of law principles, we submit that should have been the end of the analysis, that the law of the state of purchase should be deemed to apply. That means that the laws of all 50 states are implicated. There's no shortcut here to get around the choice of law issue. The district court was similarly off the mark in determining that the contract of law principles should be that of the place of design and manufacture. And for all the reasons that we have stated in the briefing, Your Honors, we believe that that decision is wrong as well, that it should be the place that has the most context with the transaction. And for the reasons we've stated in our briefing, Your Honors, we believe that that would be the place where the product is purchased. I would reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Bosner. Mr. Whiting.
May it please the court. My name is Hugh Whiting. I am here arguing on behalf of Firestone. Plaintiff's theory in this case is a propensity to fail. Plaintiffs do not allege that any actual tire failed or that any Explorer, which they owned, rolled over. Instead, they base their case and each of their causes of action on the allegation that the tires have a propensity to fail. Plaintiffs sought the application of Tennessee law to Firestone and to Bridgestone, but they point to no Tennessee decision that recognizes a propensity to fail theory as a basis for any cause of action. Plaintiffs have presented no evidence showing any propensity to fail for any non-recall tire line.
Now, you have, unlike Ford, which has filed a motion to certify it to the Supreme Court of Michigan, you have not filed a motion to certify it to the Supreme Court of Tennessee. If we certify to the Supreme Court of Michigan, what should we do about the Tennessee part?
Well, I don't know that there's an issue here that's certifiable to the Supreme Court of Tennessee, Your Honor, in terms of what's before the court now. But I believe that the question that I was addressing, the propensity to fail issue, is the subject of the court's motion to dismiss, which is not now presently before the court. The only place that we have disagreed with the court's rulings on law here with respect to Tennessee is her conclusion that a class action is permissible under the Tennessee Consumer Protection Act. We believe that on the face of that statute, a class action is not permissible, and the Tennessee Supreme Court has made clear in its analysis of that statute that the language of the statute controls. There it says a claim may be brought individually under that statute. We believe that that is the correct interpretation and that the court erred there, but we have not sought certification of that question to Tennessee. But what I was saying, Your Honor, is that the plaintiffs have made no showing of how these allegations of propensity to fail could be established with common proof. Indeed, the record evidence shows that the claims experience for Firestone tires in the tire class is not uniform and not common. The vast majority of the claims, some 72%, were with respect to recall tires. But even those tires showed only a fraction of 1% with claims. 99.95% of the APX tires made at Decatur were claim-free. With respect to the other tires, the claim rates varied. 116 of the tire types at issue have zero claims. All but 31 of the 221 tire types had less than 10 total claims. The record evidence is the same with respect to the adjustment experience. There it shows that more than 99.9% of the non-recalled Wilderness AT tires at issue in this case performed without an adjustment for tread separation. The district court's opinion does not address this evidence or its variability from tire type to tire type. And the plaintiff's failure to show how common proof can establish a tire defect is critical when you look at the many,
many different tires. How many different tire types are involved and what numbers?
Your Honor, the COJ affidavit here shows that there are 284 different tire populations. When you look at size, line, plant of manufacture, original equipment versus replacement, and the fitment for the tire in terms of the vehicle, there are about 14.2 million of the 60 million tires that were recalled by Firestone. Those are predominantly the P235 size tire of the Radial ATX and Wilderness that were used on Explorers. There are another 3 million tires that were the subject of NHTSA's decision in October of 2000, which are the subject of a Firestone replacement program. And there are another 10 million tires which were replaced, roughly, as we understand it, by the Ford replacement program.
I guess my question is, if this matter went to trial as a class action, as presently constituted, how many distinct issues of proof are we talking about with regard to the tire?
Well, Your Honor, the evidence shows in the Gardner affidavit that a tire is an integrated product and that the only way that you can assess the performance of the tire is to look at that product as it's constructed with all of its components together and the way it functions in the vehicle use for which it's intended. Each tire is made to a different specification. The evidence here shows that there are 67 different master specifications and more than 100 common green specifications. There are a range of tires made over a decade in 53 different sizes and 41 different lines. They are used on a range of different vehicles. More than half of the tires were for original equipment, sold not just to Ford and not just for Explorers, but used on other Ford vehicles, Ford Rangers and other Ford trucks, but also used on vehicles such as a GM Yukon, a Toyota Tacoma, and other vehicles. The record evidence demonstrates not only that there are these variabilities in the tires, but also that the differences in the tires make a difference. The report of NHTSA, issued in October of 2001, was before the trial court. It showed that NHTSA took into account design changes. It distinguished between tires made before a particular date in 1998 and those made after, with respect to the same size and type.
It sounds like a question that you would normally say, I'm glad you asked that.
Well, it is, Your Honor, indeed. I'm glad you did ask it. NHTSA also,
I know if you turned your page and you're responding to my question. So
NHTSA also distinguished tires based on actual design and based upon vehicle use, Your Honor. To try this case involving allegations of propensity to fail for all of the various tires in the class will require separate proofs about the design, manufacture, vehicle use for each of these different tires.
Would it be possible to include in class people who are tires that went 50,000 miles and just routinely were replaced?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
If someone had these types of tires and just used them and they worked for whatever length of time they normally work and then they changed the tire, would those people, or those, would that be part of the class since they did own those tires?
The class includes all owners of these tires made from 1991 through the present time, irrespective of the use that they have achieved and irrespective of whether they were purchased in 1991 or later. And indeed, that's another point, Your Honor, that the trial court's opinion fails to take account of. All of these tires were the subject of use. And use, actual use of the actual tires, is relevant evidence with respect to both liability and damages. The plaintiff's theory is propensity to fail. If this case were to go to trial, Firestone would seek to discover and to present evidence to the jury about each person's actual use of the tire. If a person got, as Judge Mannion said, 50,000 miles of use from a tire, we would submit that that would be relevant for the jury to assess whether or not that individual's tire was defective, whether it had a propensity to fail, and whether, in fact, that person had got what they paid for from the tire. Direct evidence that's specific to the individual and that is different from person to person. The district court failed to take into account the relevance of this evidence and the defense of Firestone in its certification decision. Its opinion does not mention that issue at all. In addition, Your Honor, there are other individual questions. This case is about warranties, about whether or not people got what they paid for, in the words of the plaintiffs. But the implied warranty of merchantability under Tennessee law is a function of whether or not the user got beneficial use, based upon the Taylor case, which we cite in our brief. Similarly, unjust enrichment. An issue with respect to unjust enrichment would be whether or not the buyer had gotten adequate use from the tire. And the same with respect to Firestone's express warranties. Those warranties only say that if the tire becomes unusable for a reason within the manufacturer's control, then there may be an adjustment on the tire depending upon tread wear at the time that the tire is presented. And with respect to the Tennessee Consumer Statute, that requires that there be an ascertainable loss causally related to the conduct that violates the statute. Once again, I would submit that use is directly relevant to the evidence and the elements of those claims. The district court's opinion simply fails.
There is a genuine problem under Tennessee law. And suppose somebody delivers a space heater, and there's a big yellow sticker on it that says, we had a little problem with one of the parts in this space heater. There's a 1 in 100 chance that it will dump carbon monoxide into your home and suffocate all of you. But we encourage you to use it, and the 99% of you who survive will not have any claims. My assumption is that most people would take them out of service fairly quickly. But on your submission, there would be no warranty claim under Tennessee law because 99% of the people could use them perfectly satisfactorily. Can that really be Tennessee law?
Your Honor, I don't know if that is Tennessee law on those facts. I think that there is a question of warranty, which is the terms of the warranty. I don't know what warranty terms your hypothetical would include, or there certainly is no Tennessee Consumer Protection Act claim based upon the facts as you have presented them, because there's a complete disclosure of the issue which you say goes to the viable use of the case. Those facts are nowhere close to the case here. The tires, which were the subject of the most substantial claims, have been recalled. They are not on the road. There is no evidence in this record, plaintiffs have given none, of propensity to fail with respect to the other tires, the non-recall tires at issue, and I would respectfully reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Whiting. Mr. Boyce.
May it please the Court, my name is David Boyce, and together with Elizabeth Cabraser, we'll be presenting the argument for appellees. I will be addressing the issue of whether you have a single product or hundreds of products involved. That is the issue of factual predominance. And Ms. Cabraser will be addressing the issue of choice of law. I want to begin with the Court's question about the space heater. I had a somewhat different analogy that I was going to present, which was of an airplane that failed 100, one out of 100 or one out of 1,000 times because of various atmospheric conditions. I think the space heater example is also something that drives home the point. If you've got a device that is going to fail some number of times, that is a defective device. That is, as the district court said, not what the person purchased it under the belief that it would do. And that has less economic value. Even if somebody will buy it, they will buy it for less. And we know that from this case because of the fact.
Of course, if there are 200 models of space heaters and have a failure rate anywhere between 10% and 1/1000th of 1%, it may be very difficult to say that there's a commonality of claims.
Exactly right, Your Honor. And that's why it's so important. And I'll take the tires and the Explorer separately. But that's why it's so important to look at the common proof that's here. Take with respect to the Explorer. It's not just the plaintiffs in this case or the district court that treated the defect in the Explorer as essentially the same defect. That's the way NHTSA did it. That's the way Ford did it. When Ford had a problem with the rollover, when it said, this vehicle, the tires lift, that's a bad thing, we've got to do something about it, they didn't say, that applies only to this model, it only applies to the vehicles under this condition of use. What did they do? They said, well, let's underinflate the tires. Let's take the tires that are designed for 35 pounds per square inch and tell people to inflate them to 26 pounds per square inch, even though they knew, and the record evidence is clear, that doing that increased the heat and increased the likelihood of tire separation. They treated the Ford Explorer as a single product in terms of this defect. NHTSA looked at this issue the same way. And the district court, having listened to the evidence, concluded that there was common class-wide proof of this common problem with the Explorer. For example, if you look at the record at 863 through 866, you will see that there's a Ford document there that is recommending certain changes be made to the Ford Explorer. Now, they agree to make those changes to the extent that it will not, quote, delay job one, close quote. Now, those of us who watch television may be confused by some of the Ford ads that talk about quality being job one. The record is clear that job one here refers to the first production of the vehicle. So what they're saying is we'll make these changes to the extent that it does not delay the first vehicle coming off the production line. And the evidence is clear that they did not make those changes. And despite the fact, this is at page 863 of the record, despite the fact that they recommended that the changes that they weren't going to make that first year be made in the next year, those changes weren't made either. Ford and Firestone recognized the problem, the common problem, with the Explorer. And if there is a distinction, and NHTSA does talk about the possibility of four, in effect, subclasses. NHTSA talks about the possibility of looking at 91 through 94, four-wheel drive, 91 through 94, two-wheel drive, 95 forward, four-wheel, 95 forward, four-wheel. So it is possible, and the district court in a footnote notes, that it might be that the evidence would develop that there would be four appropriate subclasses for the Explorer. But if you look at how Ford looks at the issue and you look at how NHTSA looks at the issue, you don't have an infinite number of issues. You have a single common defect, and that was the design of the Explorer, and that design remained essentially stable throughout the period. And what you had is a recognition within the Ford documents, within the Firestone documents, when they talk about the problems of underinflating their tires, and you look at NHTSA, you see the basis for the common class-wide proof of this issue with respect to Ford.
Tell me again what the nature of the loss suffered with regard to the Ford vehicle is.
Okay. When consumers purchased this vehicle to begin with, they were getting something that was not what they had bargained for. They had bargained for the space heater without the defect. They had bargained for the Ford product without this defect, and indeed the person, Mr. Scott, who's in charge of the Ford Explorer program, says that safety and security of that vehicle was, quote, a purchase differentiator for the Explorer. That's at 828 of the record. And what he explains he means by that is you get more money because consumers believe that there is a safety differential between Explorer and other such vehicles. Now, what happened was when the facts became known in late 2000, early 2001, and this is at, it's graphically illustrated at pages 613 through 616 of the record. The resale value of the Explorers plummeted, approximately $600 per vehicle. What happened was, just as in the old-fashioned securities case, where you've got information that is concealed, that information is revealed and the stock price drops. Here you had a situation where this information was concealed. People were told that these space heaters had this defect, and the price dropped.
Now, did the price drop in different amounts in different parts of the United States?
Only at the margin, Your Honor. There was some differences.
All life occurs at the margin.
All life occurs at the margin. If you look at these charts,
I'm using that for example of Blue Book prices for vehicles varies from region to region within a state and so forth.
Yes, the Blue Book does vary, but what you will find, and I commend these charts that are in the record and the evidence that's in the record, what you will find is that the differential by which these values dropped was less on a region-by-region basis than the Blue Book price would have been on a region-by-region basis for the vehicle before the drop in price. That is to say, how much you can resell a Explorer that's 4 years old may be different in Arizona than in New York. But in both Arizona and New York, when the truth became apparent, the vehicle price dropped precipitously. So that what you have here...
I took my colleague's question, though, to be, did it drop by the same amount? And if I understand at least what some of the people have said in public, the tire separation tendency has something to do with heat, which suggests that there probably would have been a bigger drop in Arizona than in Alaska.
If the people in Alaska were confident that they weren't going to ever drive in Arizona, and
it's
if...
It's hard to get a vehicle from Alaska to Arizona.
Particularly from Juneau.
And everyone in Alaska has an SUV. There is no... You know, there's nothing smaller than a truck in Alaska.
And I will confess, Your Honor, that I have not looked at the specific amount of money that it dropped in Alaska, nor was that put forward to the district court by the defendants. However, if you look at the drop that took place in the continental United States, what you saw was a common drop. And that's in part.
And how can one verify that this is a response to the truth as opposed to fright value? About 10 years ago, when CBS ran its utterly bogus show alleging that Audis suddenly spurted forward at high speed, even when the brake was depressed, the price of Audis plummeted. It was later revealed that this was a fraud on CBS's part. How does one infer reliably from a drop that it's a drop in response to an actual defect rate rather than in response to allegations?
Well, I would suggest, Your Honor, that it's always a drop in response to information. That information may, as you point out, be true or false. And what we have the obligation of showing is that in this situation, the evidence was true. And we have, for that proposition, as the district court found from an extensive examination of facts,
right,
persuasive evidence that it is true here.
Why that worries me, because if there are, in Firestone's claim is 67 master specifications, suppose the allegation is true with respect to 22 of those master specifications and false with respect to 45, or true to a different degree, that the risks differ across those specifications. Doesn't that give us serious problems with commonality of claims?
And the court has quite properly now moved from the the Ford example that I was talking about to the Firestone example. And with respect to the Firestone example, I quite agree with the court that we have the same obligation to convince the court below and to convince the court here that the court below was right, that that is subject to common proof. First, with respect to those so-called 67 master specifications, they have the last word, and I'm sure they will tell you where in the record evidence there is any record evidence that there are 67 master specifications that are materially different. I don't believe that that's in the record because I don't believe that's true. I believe what the record shows, and I commend the court here to page 568 of the record, that you will find that for every one of the tires at issue, they had the same skim stock, the layer of rubber. They had no safety cap plies. And third, there was no belt edge strips, all of which, the evidence is, were the cause of the defect. And this defect and this evidence is common to all of the tires. They talk about 60 million Firestone tires. They have the last word, and I'm sure they will tell you, if there are any of those 60 million Firestone tires that had a safety ply cap or that had a belt edge strip.
I guess your argument is that every tire produced, if subject to certain conditions, would fail.
I'm not sure that I would go that far, Your Honor.
What I'm saying is that there's commonality of what caused the separation.
There is commonality of what causes the separation. However, I think it is the case that whether a tire with this defect separates, or whether and I've noticed my white line is on, and I need to stop. Because I don't want to.
No, you can keep going. That just tells you how much is left in your 15 minutes.
Okay, because I don't want to take.
Yeah, Ms. Grazer will have her 15.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
Commonality with regard to tire separation.
Right. I've now totally lost my train of thought, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
I ask you, does that mean that every tire produced within this period
right.
of time would fail?
Right. And whether a tire with this defect actually fails is going to depend on a lot of the circumstances that they identify. The use of it, how hot the temperature is, how much it's driven, how it's loaded, things like that. I asked the court, though, to make the distinction between what causes the defect and what causes that defect to, in turn, result in a failure. It is a design defect. The use of the vehicle doesn't affect whether that is a design defect or not. It does affect whether that design defect will result in tread separation. But like the space heater example, once you know that this product has this defect and has, in their language, not ours, but their language, a propensity to fail in terms of the way they want to describe it in terms of this hearing, then people are going to pay less for it if they're going to buy it at all. And the same thing is true with respect to the Explorer. It is true that whether an Explorer actually tips over or not is going to depend how you drive it.
Now you're on Mr. Grazer's time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Cabrera.
Thank you, Your Honors. Over 30 years ago, in Phillips Petroleum versus Schutz, the Supreme Court ruled that courts, state courts, and by implication federal courts, could constitutionally certify nationwide classes, assuming Rule 23 criteria were met, and to facilitate that, they could choose a single state's law. if the choice of law analysis were constitutionally permissible. Phillips talked about a context-based analysis. And courts and, I guess more to the point, lawyers have been ignoring that studiously ever since. Defendants cite too many cases of attempts by plaintiffs to certify nationwide classes in cases relating to products.
I don't understand those to be constitutional decisions. Our first question here is simply an eerie question. We're commanded to apply the choice of law rule to the forum state, which here is Indiana. And the main problem for you is that there don't appear to be any Indiana cases holding that as a matter of law, the place of design has to be used nationwide.
Your Honor, there is...
We don't even think about the Constitution until we get past the normal Erie Railroad problems.
Your Honor, the case that establishes and articulates Indiana's choice of law doctrine both for tort and contract, the two standards that were correctly applied by the district court in this case, the Hubbard versus Greeson case, does apply. The law of the state of the design and manufacture of a product to a claim by the survivor of someone who was killed by that product. Much stronger case for the concept of the place of injury being significant than here, where we're dealing with no personal injuries, standardized products, standardized warranties, standardized conduct and knowledge on the part of the defendants, and yes, standardized design decisions and standardized manufacturers. But in that single instance case, the Indiana Supreme Court established its conflict doctrines for both contract and tort and looked at a comparison between insignificant and significant contact. And what would be a significant contact would depend entirely upon the factual circumstances of the case and the nature of the claims asserted. So it is not simply a situation of saying lex loci. Indiana moved away from lex loci. And in fact, lex loci, under most modern choice of law regimes, is simply the default from choice of law. It's the no choice choice. And that's the choice, Your Honor, that too many courts have made attempting to address issues of nationwide classes, which is where the Phillips case comes in. We're not suggesting this is a case of constitutional dimension. In fact, the district court here scrupulously adhered to Indiana's choice of law doctrine to make the choices that needed to be made about significant contacts in both the tort and contract.
If you have to pick an Indiana case on which to rely for the proposition that the Supreme Court of Indiana would choose the law of the state of manufacture in a product liability case, what Indiana case would that be?
Your Honor, leaving aside the point that this is not, strictly speaking, a product liability case, because we're not talking about personal injury or death, we're talking about consumer.
My next question will be, what case will you rely on for the proposition that Indiana will choose the law of the place of manufacture in a warranty case?
We rely on two cases, and these are the cases that the district court applied. First, the Hubbard versus Greeson case, for the reasons that I stated.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, the PMG Pete Marwick versus Asher case, Indiana Court of Appeal case, addressing accountant negligence. That's a tort conflict decision, holding that the place of the negligent conduct, the accounting negligence, was more significant than the place where the 600 Indiana farmers resided and where they had stored their grain. Much closer case than this in terms of comparison of contacts to determine the contacts with the most intimate connection to the issues in the case. Your Honor, in most single instances, product liability cases, accident cases, you're not going to have a situation where the issue gets raised. The conflicts issue gets raised. In Greeson, it was raised in a wrongful death suit. In many cases, it isn't raised, it isn't addressed, the forum law applies. Here, it would not have been correct to simply apply the forum law.
Actually, it gets raised, at least in federal litigation, all the time. It that Indiana has not only a statute of limitations, but a statute of repose. And the manufacturers are always here attempting to take advantage of the Indiana statute of repose, which we routinely hold Indiana would apply because it would apply its domestic law to this product liability case.
Your Honor, in fact, the Indiana statute of repose was applied in the Land case. And if you look at the facts of that case, there was a very intimate, long-standing contact with Indiana. This was a boat case, or a Wave Runner was the name of the product, and it had been in Indiana, used in Indiana for over 10 years. Here, where we're dealing with breaches that occur upon sale or delivery that don't involve, for their vitality, long-standing use, where the same product is designed in the same way, sold under the same warranty for all states, there's no Indiana special that is sold in Indiana on the part of either Firestone or Ford. And so our point is that the heart of Indiana choice of law doctrine is to look at the significance of the contacts with respect to the conduct at issue and the claim at issue. And because this case sounds in consumer, our product liability claims were dismissed. This case sounds in Consumer Protection Act claims, breach of warranty, and unjust enrichment, where, as the district court held, the conduct of the defendants in creating, designing, manufacturing, selling the product, and bringing it into a particular state are what counts. There's no difference.
What is your amount of loss to be proved in this case?
The amount of loss, as Mr. Boies indicated, is proved with respect to the value the good would have if it were as represented.
The value what?
The value the good would have if it were as represented, and the value that it actually has. Using.
I understand the basic, but I mean, actually, how are you going to prove that?
Market data.
From where?
From information gathered by the experts and
nationwide market data, or
yes,
by state, or what?
Well, it's nationwide in the aggregate, but there are geographical regions that are used. With respect, for example, to the unjust enrichment claim, that relates to Ford's wholesale price, and that doesn't vary geographically. With respect to other data in terms of cost of replacement of a tire, for example, that can vary geographically, but it tends to be categorical, and it can be identified and calculated.
Does that affect choice of law at all?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe it does affect choice of law, because the basic concepts of that type of damage are universal when you're dealing with warranty or Consumer Protection Act claims, which all the states have. I think, Your Honor, the point here about choice of law is that the defendants didn't want the district court to make a correct choice of law, and we think the district court did. They wanted the district court to make no choice of law. They wanted the district court to merely stay on lex locus, to use the default position. And some courts have done that, faced with nationwide classes. That would be wrong under significant contacts analysis, as Indiana uses. That would be wrong under interest analysis that other courts use. And the case we cite as the example is this circuit's air crash disaster near Chicago, not a class action, a case involving far tougher choice of law issues, a case demonstrating that courts can and do and must make hard choices, answer hard questions about the application of law that is going to substantially impact the claims of those before them. In that case, after 38 pages of analysis of multiple choice of law regimes, this court decided to apply the place of injury with respect to punitive damages claims, not because it was in itself significant. Indeed, this court held place of injury standing alone is not significant. It's a mere fortuity. But in that case, the place of injury coincidentally coincided with the place of the airport and the place of the state with a huge interest in both air safety and in attracting and protecting airlines.
Case involved not Ford but Hyundai, would you be arguing that Korean substantive law applies?
Your Honor, if this case involved Hyundai and if the significant design decisions and manufacturing decisions and warranty and marketing all took place in Korea, that might be a hard choice that a court had to make. We're not faced with that choice in this case.
If Indiana would choose the place of manufacturer, it would choose Korea as well as Michigan. And I don't know any way around that. And I assume that on your view, Indiana would choose Michigan and Tennessee, even if it were crystal clear on the law of those states, as it is in the law of some states, that your clients have no claim.
Your Honor, in that instance, I think the interest aspect of choice of law regimes would come into play.
So that your view really is Indiana would choose whichever law is most favorable to plaintiffs?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe that either, and that's not what I'm suggesting. What I'm suggesting is that there is, as this court recognized in Air Disaster, there is an interest element in both contact-based and comparative interest analyses. It's a matter of emphasis, but where...
I think one has to take the bitter with the sweet.
Perhaps, and as this court held in Air Disaster, hard choices must be made, and choice of law has consequences. Here it's the defendants that wish to avoid the consequences of choice of law, despite their legitimate interests, solely because they believed that a failure to choose a single state's law would doom the class certification procedure. It has in other cases. It should not have done so in other cases. Here we had evidence, not argument, about a common defect, and that is in the record of the transcript. And Firestone did not have persuasive countervailing evidence of multiplicitous separate defects. The court weighed the evidence, as no other courts have done. The court made a hard choice of law decision, which few other courts have done. The court did not shrink from that task. As a result, it was able to find common legal issues predominating. By the way, Your Honors, there is no need to certify any questions on damages or actionability to either the Tennessee or Michigan courts, both Supreme Courts.
Yeah, I don't understand your position there. If we conclude that Indiana would point to Michigan or Tennessee to supply the law for very large numbers of people, don't you think it's prudent to ensure that the federal court applies authentic state law?
Yes, Your Honor, and that is my point precisely. My point is that authentic state law, the law as articulated by the Supreme Court of Tennessee in 1929 in Tennessee Roofing and Tile Company versus Eli on a breach of warranty claim, establishes that there is no requirement that a product actually fail. If a product is not as warranted, is not as represented, and that is discovered, that is when the cause of action for breach of warranty accrues, and the damages are the difference in value between the product as warranted and the product received. In that case, combustible bricks were sold and a house was built. The plaintiffs were not required to wait for that house to catch fire to see how combustible those bricks really were. The bricks were cement coated, they were warranted as fireproof. As the building was halfway through, they were found not to be. That was the claim, that was the damage. Similarly, in Michigan, Mayhall versus A.H. Pond, we cite that case. It's a court of appeal case, but it cites four Michigan Supreme Court cases going back to 1867, holding that there is no requirement that property fail, be destroyed, that there be any damages or injury other than not getting what was bargained for. Mayhall was the case of the ring sold as perfect, which wasn't. It cited Supreme Court cases involving property with defective title. No ouster from the property was required, no failure of rents was required, to hold that the claim in accrued and damage had been incurred because something was sold that did not meet the reasonable expectations of the buyer. Mayhall is a Consumer Protection Act claim. The cases it cites are fraud claims. The Tennessee case is a warranty claim. Those are not anomalous propositions, Your Honors. That is the law throughout the country, and that is the law in the states that the district court chose to apply.
Thank you very much, Mr. Brazier.
Your Honor, the plaintiff's burden here, as I believe that they acknowledge, is that they have the burden of showing that they can prove each element of each claim presented here on a class-wide basis. With respect to defect, Mr. Boies talked about a lot of early documents while we were developing the Explorer. What he fails to mention is, of course, at that time we only had one Explorer. That's the one that we were experimenting with. It's interesting in this case that the main allegation is of an unreasonable propensity to roll over. It's a statistical issue. How often does this happen? And it's intriguing to me that plaintiffs refuse to go anywhere near that question. These vehicles have been on the road for 11 years. Why don't they? We put statistics in the record. They're there. And they show two very interesting things. They show, one, that the rate of rollover incidents with the Explorers vary, such that you cannot make an across-the-board yes or no determination about all of these vehicles simultaneously. And secondly, they show the performance is well within competitive sport utility vehicles. In short, they can't use it to show a defect. That's why they're not talking about statistics here, and that's why they are unable to show class-wide proof. It's similarly the case that the data vary with respect to their defect theories, low center of gravity and high oversteer. That varies among Explorers. They're different. And that's not being mentioned here, and they've not refuted that in the record. It shows that class-wide proof is not available. Finally, I'd make just a final point with respect to a point that Judge Mannion made earlier. You've got to look at the other element of the claim that are here. In unjust enrichment, you're not only talking about enrichment, you're talking about the unjust element. If someone buys a vehicle and they got 176,000 miles of incident-free service out of that vehicle, as one of the named plaintiffs has done, Ford has got a right to put that information before the court or the jury, because it's hard to see where there's anything unjust in that result. They got a vehicle that performed beautifully for them. And it also raises questions about whether that person can argue that the vehicle is unmerchantable under that circumstance. And so those other elements of the claim must be focused upon here. There are numerous other respects as well in terms of just the enrichment element of unjust enrichment.
I mean, doesn't the proposition you're making depend ultimately on the underlying substantive law? Let me give you an example. We've had a long-running series of cases in the Seventh Circuit dealing with a particular brand of plastic plumbing that was installed and has a tendency to leak. It's installed in a lot of houses and commercial buildings. The question was whether people had a claim involving that plumbing, and if so, what it was and when it accrued. It's come up in tort cases and bankruptcy cases and a whole bunch of other cases. And are you now saying that in each of these cases there needs to be person-specific proof about how many gallons of water passed through the plumbing before it finally leaked, as opposed to answering eventually the general question whether the plumbing has to be replaced or repaired, or whether everybody gets a credit, which can then be used to buy insurance for eventual leaks if leaks happen? I mean, one could go in one way or the other, but I would think it's a question of the underlying substantive law rather than of natural justice or something like
but
that.
Your Honor, if you look at the claims asserted here, unmerchantability, unjust enrichment, things of those sorts. If those claims were brought individually, Ford would have the right to put forward the sort of evidence I was just talking about in those cases. We'd have a right to show that there was incident-free, wonderful service from the vehicle against the individual who comes into court and says, there's a defect here, or that the vehicle is unmerchantable, or that Ford was unjustly enriched by selling this vehicle. Under the Rules Enabling Act, Rule 20...
I just don't understand how you say that as a blank proposition without respect to the underlying substantive law. Our plastic plumbing case, by the way, was decided by the Supreme Court of Illinois last year, contrary to our prediction, as saying that there was no claim at all until it leaked. Go away. And they apparently don't like that answer because they've granted rehearing and it's now under advisement again.
Well,
what answer we have to give in these cases is going to depend on what the Supreme Court of Illinois does. And it seems to me you need an underlying state law to answer
And Your Honor, the responses I've given to you were based on Michigan law that indicate that we would have the right to come in and make those presentations both in the unjust enrichment and the unmerchantability case. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Bosner. Mr. Whiting, anything further?
I want to address 4 points. The first is a point that plaintiffs made at the outset of their argument, recognizing that they have the burden And they do have the burden under Rule 23 to demonstrate compliance with each aspect of that rule, including the fact that there is a sufficient commonality among the tires at issue to warrant class treatment. They said, where's the evidence? The evidence of 67 tire specifications is in two Firestone documents submitted by plaintiffs in their bench book at tab B10 and tab B11. The evidence is in two affidavits of Mr. Gardner, where he makes clear that a tire is an integrated product, that each tire has a separate specification, that no single component in that tire can determine performance, and that skim stock does not define the performance of a tire. All of that evidence was before the district court. The opinion of the district court does not come to grips with any of it, and I submit that under Zabel, the record evidence is clear that the court committed clear error in her predominance finding. The plaintiffs say this case is about standardized conduct. The tires at issue in this case are 60 million tires sold over a decade, some two-thirds or so of which on OE tires, many for Ford, many for other vehicles, bought through GM dealers, bought through Toyota dealers, bought through Mazda dealers, bought over a course of a decade, used on different vehicles, bought in Sears stores for replacement, bought at Firestone-owned stores. There is no standardized conduct. The record shows that even the warranties, the existence and terms of warranty, are a function of the multiple channels of distribution. A person gets a different warranty for an OE tire, a different warranty for a tire bought from a Firestone dealer, and no warranty from a tire bought from a mass merchandiser. There is no standardized product, there is no standardized warranty, and there is no standardized conduct in this case. The plaintiffs talk about the Tennessee roofing case and the Tennessee Consumer Act cases. Those cases involve an identifiable, affirmative statement that a product is something and the product was not. Firestone's warranty is not that kind of warranty. Indeed, on the face of the warranty, it says there is not a warranty that tires will not fail. And it goes through the reasons tires can fail with the warnings about care and proper inflation that are necessary for tires to perform properly. Yes, this is about state law. And the cases we have cited demonstrate that the causes of action and warranty, unjust enrichment, and Consumer Act all depend upon use. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Whiting. Thanks to all counsel.